I'm Kerry Eddins, and you're listening to Kerry's Connoisseurs, coming to you from Solid Gold Podcasts. Here we talk to the movers and shakers, the drinkers, the dreamers, and all the people who make it happen in the liquor and luxury industries from around the world. Well, hello, everybody. Today, in my studio, which I haven't used very much this year at all. In fact, Emil is only the second person that I've interviewed this year, and I'll give you reasons or excuses as to why I've been so tardy. But Emil Joubert, welcome to Kerry's Connoisseurs. It's, what day is it today? It's Thursday before Good Friday. How are you?
Good morning, Kerry, the connoisseur. Always lovely to talk to you. And I think the last time we chatted was actually last year, so not this year. But the way time rumbles ahead at the speed of light, I do not blame you.
I know. And I just thought to myself the other day, you and I have been threatening to do another podcast because we had a very happy podcast that was well received by all my people who love me and who love you. And we chatted so terribly easily, and there were lots more things to unpack and unravel. And I've been promising to do it now for about 6 months and haven't got that far. So today's the day, and it's already Easter time. Can you imagine? It's Easter tomorrow.
The thinking process slows down. The thinking process, the planning phases start slowing down a little bit at our age, Kerry, if you don't mind me saying so.
And I
try to work it out the other day, and not trying to sound irresponsible, but I think since the age of 23, I've probably consumed 5 bottles of wine a week at least, up until the age of 60 I'm at now. So I'm at my peak now, so you better talk.
Wow,
we don't know where it's going to go from here on.
It can only go downhill from here.
I believe
it's downhill.
I believe it goes.
I can't claim to be quite as proficient as you in the drinking stakes, but I think if I average it out, maybe a bottle a day, but not since the age of 20. What did you say, 23?
Yeah, that's when I stopped drinking a lot of beer. From 16 to 23, it was all beer. Then I discovered wine when I was about 23 years old. All my mates were drinking, remember Goldtropfen and Grünbergerstein and these kind of things?
I do.
And then I had folks who were into wine, and they kind of drank, they liked dry white wine. And so I started drinking Paderberg Steen, now known as Schenen, of course. And at that age, I discovered the world of dry wines, which opened up
I was chatting quite recently with, I think, Tim Hutchinson from DGB, who, as you know, is just such a legend in our South African wine industry.
Sure.
And I didn't really drink at all until I was about, I had the odd drink and got silly drunk at parties here and there and what have you, but I wasn't mad about alcohol. I didn't like the taste. And I think I started drinking wine at also around about 24-ish. But by that stage, everybody was onto Bellingham Grand Cru. It was dreadful. It was awful. You couldn't drink it. It was so dry.
And then it became a way of life. It just became a way of life, for both of us.
It did become a way of life. And, you know, even to this day, when I am putting together a cellar for a client, which I do quite a lot and I love it, I always tell them that those huge cellars that have got thousands of bottles of wine in them, they're very impressive to the eye, but so often is the time that I then get called in like 10 years later to say, we've got 2,000 bottles of wine here. It's just going old. It's gathering dust. We don't want it. What do we do with it? And then you actually end up giving it away for virtually nothing. So when I install cellars for customers, my advice is 365 bottles of wine. So it's one for every day of the year, and then one or two for the angels, because we know that they steal a bit from the cellar every now and again. And working on the premise that you're not going to drink a bottle of wine every day, but some mm-hmm. days you are going to drink four bottles of wine, and then some weeks you might not drink any, if you're a responsible citizen, Emil.
I don't do dry January. I outgrew that. But the whole thing is about wine for me. Yes, it's a thing about drinking, and people say you always with alcohol and so on. I mean, it's being not only being a line of work, but a real passion for me. Like looking at stamps is for a philatelist, or people who build model boats in bottles and so on. It's become a way of life, and it's become a reference field for me. So every bottle, I'm not saying I score every bottle I drink or whatever, but I really appreciate where it's from, albeit a Père Bastien, or fortunately now and again a Burgundy or a Bordeaux. I kind of find something in that wine that pulls me back to its place of origin. So it's a hobby, it's a lifestyle, it's a fashion fascination. And fortunately, it's also my profession. So how lucky can one be?
I know, we said that the last time, which is what prompted me to phone you again, because we both have a job that is our hobby. It's such fun. It's very lucky. It's very fortunate to have your hobby as your job. Mm-hmm. The reality, though, is, as you say, is that you don't drink and score every single bottle. But I also love the art and craft of not only winemaking, whiskey making, beer brewing, everything. I love the art and craft of alcohol more really than the drinking thereof. But it's the art and craft and everything that goes into it, how the bottle looks, the label, the nuances, the closure, the foils, the colors, the sort of dream that went behind it. You know, it's a very creative space. So I think for anybody who's even vaguely creative, it's a really nice career to go into,
and
if you like.
But wine more so than any other beverage. With all respect, I mean, whiskey is made from wheat and barley and cereals.
Be careful, I love whiskey, you know.
So do I. But just compare that to wine, which comes from every country in the world. South Africa has 8,000 brands alone, which all comes from different areas. And expresses the nuances of the terroir and the geography where they preside. And every vintage is different. Take this vintage, for example, 2024. You said we were going to talk about.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about. Give me report for all our listeners.
Yeah.
What was the 2024?
No, so, I mean, just getting back to wine, this is what makes wine so intriguing. And I think the most challenging of all those beverages you mentioned, because you can have the greatest scientist in the cellar, the most nuanced winemaker, the best equipment, but if you don't have good grapes, it doesn't not going to give you a good wine. And it all depends on
if the barley is not nice. You're not whiskey.
Then you get the millies from the previous year. You just open the warehouse and get the corn and the oats and the stuff that's been drying there and all that kind of stuff. Grapes have a 365-day cycle before they're harvested, and it can change. This year's harvest has been really one for, I would call it the record books. It's been low yielding. There is a bit of panic.
Could you give your dog a glass of Chardonnay in the background?
Jeez, like, it's not my dog, it's a neighbor's dog.
Glass of Chardonnay.
It's very low yield vineyards, because what happened, we had a hell of a lot of rain last year.
Yeah.
It was really wet. It rained in March, when some people were already harvesting.
It rained the whole year on and off.
It rained in March when the red wines were coming in. Most of the whites had been off the vines, but it rained during the red wine harvest. So how the 2023 red wines are going to pan out in a year or two's time, which are in barrel now, we don't know. I mean, some people have written off the 2023 vintage. Yeah, because of those huge rains we had in March. But the rain didn't stop there, so it went on, continued throughout the year. We had a cold winter, a wet winter, and what happened, as you know, when the grapes are picked and the vines just start shutting down slowly, they lose their leaves, and they go into a state of dormancy for winter when the pruning happens. Mm. And so everybody thought, because it was such a cold winter and wet, we're going to have very slow lead up to vintage 2024 in terms of bud break and veraison coming towards the growing season. But when the first rays of sun hit the vineyards in August, actually, those vineyards just jumped out of their slumber like the clappers, you know, went absolutely ballistic, and they grew at such a state. I mean, Chardonnay, for example, was the buds were breaking some areas a month before the traditional periods of early September, end of August. So it's very early growing season. And so the grapes went off like the clappers, and everybody thought this is going to be a huge season. Then, of course, we had tremendous rains in September. You had heard about, remember, 24th September? With rains, floods, rock falls, you name it. Franschhoek, Jemelen Aarde, Caledon, those areas just about washed away because we had rain coming in from the southeast. That affected a lot of the vines and growing. But then we thought, okay, one thing at least we don't have a problem with is water, because it's so damn wet. In 2023, we had some regions who were averaging 600 millimeters of rain, getting 1,200 millimeters of rain. But then, Carrie, you've spent some time in the Cape. In October, the southeaster started blowing last year.
Mm.
Gale force southeaster, relentlessly. Then you add
so
to that...
Did you get lots of disease? Because that's what I was worried about.
The southeaster blew the disease totally away. And so what the wind did, it parched the grounds. I mean, people thought they weren't going to have to irrigate for the 2024 season. But I mean, by November, December, those that were irrigating were having to get the pumps going because the soil was so dry, despite that heat.
Despite
that wetness, we had so much heat and wind, the soils drew out. And the vines just started growing at a rate of knots. That's why the harvest this year was about 2 to 3 weeks earlier than normal, because of the heat and the wind.
Which just goes to show
the effects of the weather. Because last year's winter, coldest in years, wettest in years, yet the vines didn't hold back when the skies opened up and gave us a bit of heat. So the grapes ripened like the clappers. There were so many bunches in the vineyards. Everybody was predicting this massive harvest because of this early ripening and this rapid ripening and the heat we were getting in June and January and February. But guess what? Pickers went out, picked the grapes. The grapes were coming in, and their weights were 30 to 40% less than usual. So a bunch of Shiraz that'll normally weigh 900 grams, a big healthy bunch, was coming in at 600 grams. Same amount of berries, big looking bunch, but the weights were just less. And it was that stress caused by that heat.
Water.
And we're sitting in a situation now where people I've spoken to is some areas with Chardonnay, we're down 50% in volume. 50%. Yeah, we're talking about huge, I mean, proper winemaking regions. And same with, not, Shannon isn't affected so badly. I mean, Shannon can grow in, I mean, that guy
Shannon's
who made the
so
movie.
Generous, it just gives.
The guy who made that movie, Oppenheimer, he could have planted a couple of Shannon vineyards right next to the bomb and they would still survive. So Shannon tickled on, although the weights were slightly less, like 10-20%. And the red grapes coming in now are sort of 30% less. So we're going to have a lower crop, which can put pressure because there is a wine shortage in South Africa. For your big brands, you know, your big volume brands.
I was going to say, is there really
there's a wine shortage
in South Africa?
And your exports, we've got export contracts to fulfill bulk wines and big brands, bottles and so on. So there is a pressure on the industry at the moment in terms of the volumes we've got, which are low. But having said that, and having written copious press releases on low vintages, the old cliche is always less grapes, better quality. And that actually does seem to have worked, or that is applicable to 2023. Because the reds are still fermenting, but the white wines I've tasted from barrel fermenting, the juice coming in, wines that have finished fermenting, the quality is really, really incredible. I'm telling you that.
Well,
I mean,
I'm already looking at
my top Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay producers and putting in orders for when their wines are bottled. Dimmersdale, for example, in Durbanville, who were not affected by the yields, the low yields. Their crop was normal. Taste Low is an exceptional farmer, and he's pruned these vineyards to such an extent that they just keep on delivering the volumes, even though he doesn't irrigate. It's all dryland vines. And he already had his first Sauvignon in the market February 24, 25.
Well, he's famous
about
for
five weeks after crushing. Yeah, but I looked at it this time. I thought that taste, you know. But it was such a polished wine.
Everybody always says it's going to be tasting horrible. Chase is releasing his wine too early and it's not going to be enough.
The wine is 5 weeks old. Sauvignon. It was 5 weeks old, and I said to Taste, but it was polished. Now, it didn't have that bit of static electricity you find in young wines that have just been bottled preemptively, but a couple of weeks earlier than they should. It was rounded and expressive, and had great palate weight, and flavors were controlled. You know, you could see that it wasn't manipulated in any sense. And I said to Taste, I said, woof, what did you do in the cellar to get the wine quality? He said, it's from the vineyard. No, so that's the end of the day. It's the quality of wine is determined solely by vineyards. There's a lot of gadgets you can throw in these days, really. You can throw in, I mean, there's different yeasts and sulfur levels and so forth. You can use different maturation vessels, but all comes down to the vineyard. And what I'm seeing now from Elgin, I spent a lot of time with the Kluvers, Pinot Noir Chardonnay, De Wetzhoff Chardonnay, Stellenbosch at Delheim, Alta as well, and the qualities are really looking fantastic, despite the lower yields.
I think
it's going to be a welcome, and particularly the big guns. You know, if one's buying wine from the likes of Canonkop, Risten Frieda, Thai Bors. I tend to stick to the more classic Bordeaux style when it comes to red. There's no reason to believe that those wines are not going to be stupendous from 2024. But then again, the wine industry doesn't provide one of the crystal ball. So you can't see what's going to happen after they've been down barrel for a year or two. But as far as the structures and the presence and the colors of the wines look now, it does look to be a great harvest. And still ongoing. Some areas out in Rawsonville, Slanghoek are still doing their red wines. So those winemakers will miss Easter. But most of the winemakers have told me they'll be having their first Easter break in 20, 30 years' time. I spoke to Tash's Bolson from Stunrist yesterday. He says 20 years of winemaking. It's the first time he's finished before Easter.
Well, you know, thank you for that summary on the harvest, because that's what I wanted from you, and it's perfect. It's also what I'd heard. But a little snippet from me, the Luddite. It is South Africa's 365th vintage this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think if you and I were to go back and look at the 365 harvests that we've had over those years, there's nothing unusual about what you've just summarized for us. It happens. It's cyclical. It happens. And as
Absolutely.
You say quite correctly, I think that we are very lucky that we've got some farmers, and the South African wine industry has come of age to a point where we know how to sort of roll with those punches. We know how to roll with the geographical punches, because it's farming at the end of the day. It is farming.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get a missus in the Mililanda. Sometimes you just don't get any mealies. Sometimes your bubbles don't
we're
bubble.
Quite right.
Sometimes
no,
it's fine.
Quite right.
And I think
I remember hot. You know, I remember so hotter vintages 20 years ago.
Me, there's so much messing about and making excuses and global warming this and schmancy fancy that it's farming. The planet Earth does its own thing. The only problem that we have is that there are too many people on planet Earth, so that's what the problem is. It's got nothing to do with global warming. But the vintage, like every other vintage that sent the farmers a pain in the bum every morning and every night, and they've had to work really, really hard to get those grapes in before they all frazzled in the sun or got washed down the alley in the rain. It is always the case that when your bunches are smaller, the intensity is there. So you get that wonderful intensity of fruit that you've spoken about, and I'm so excited about the harvest. And I don't think there's anything wrong with a wine-producing region that has one or two vintages where they don't have that much product. You know, there's a supply and demand economic that we all know about as well. And as a retailer, I know that when the demand is bigger than the supply, the can sell those things for any amount of money. So it's good. It's good in every way. So we're just going to look for the good bits about what I think was quite a tasty, difficult harvest for our farmers.
Yeah, I must concur. And the other thing is, we've been farmers for 365 years, but you know, the approach to viticulture over the past 30, 40 years has changed dramatically. I saw that. I'm old enough to have seen it. I mean, I think 30 years ago, you look at the big co-ops, there wasn't a co-op with a viticulturist. The farmers farmed.
I'm going to ask you about co-ops.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a big question about co-ops.
The farmers would be their own viticulturists. Not bad all the time. But they would just pick. I worked at a co-op. I worked at Simon's Flay. And you never knew what was coming your way in the days. You know, someday the trucks will just line up with 2,000 bins of Stien, and next day there'd be 100 bins of Cinsault. It wasn't planned, it was just farmed. But so the whole approach towards viticulture has changed dramatically in the past 30, 40 years. And that's really led to improving in wine quality. And it keeps the vines in the soil longer. They start using cover crops, regenerative agriculture, less water, really managing the plant finer. So we've really, that's been one of the major developments over the past 30, 40 years, has been the accent on farming itself.
It's become more sophisticated, hasn't it? I mean, I was having a discussion the other evening that I wished I'd had you with me for. And we were talking about the days of the cooperatives, because when we were all at varsity and what have you, we used to buy cooperative wine. I mean, the government used to guarantee the purchase of whatever the growers grew, and they put the money into the farmers got 2% land bank loans, so they were never going insolvent. They could sell all their harvest because the government bought it all. And the government also funded the cooperative. So at the end of the day, the farmers, whilst they didn't have the return on ego that they have now, because they didn't have their own label and they didn't have their own lofty heights that they could shoot the lights out with, they got paid. And the wine farming fraternity was a happy middle class. Nobody was hugely wealthy, but everybody was making a living. And I think all that beautiful Chenin Blanc in the Swartland went into the KWV brandy, mostly. But the cooperatives worked. And I look at the situation that we find ourselves in now, and I ask all my learned friends in the industry, do you think that there is still space for a more sophisticated kind of cooperative system in South Africa?
I think the co-ops are great. Gary, that's the backbone of the wine industry. Now, I always, you know, when you talk, we tend, the wines we read about and it's talked about, these are your single vineyard Chardonnays and Cabernet Sauvignons or Bordeaux blends of 200 to 300 rand. We all love that. But 85% of wine sold in South Africa is less than 50 rand a litre. No, those are the people who drink wine. You find that in the country. I mean, Bordeaux, you find wine's 4 or 5 euros a bottle. I mean, Bordeaux makes more wine than the whole of South Africa. And if wine's a 4 or 5 euros, these are the people who drink wine as a way of life. Not necessarily want to talk about it, or I wouldn't say not care what they're drinking, but they like a dry red or a dry white or a semi-sweet white. And that's the backbone of the industry. And I think in supplying those, and that make no mistake, big famous brands, Stellenbosch brands, buy in wines from co-ops that are such well made that they put them in their Stellenbosch branded bottles. Okay, I've got a bugbear with that, but that's for a different day. The quality of wines in the co-ops is incredible. And I mean, if you want to do yourself a treat, come with me and my dad. My dad's a pensioner, and we drive out to Breeder Kloof. And you stop up at some of these co-ops, you buy unwitted Chardonnays, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnays, Pinotage, for between 50 and 60 rand a bottle, you know. And some of those wines could stand up with really platter 4, 4.5 star wines. And the co-ops know. And the co-ops know that the people who buy their wines, like the DGBs or the Heinekens or the KWV, quality, they judged on quality. It's not like the old day. You know, you just rocked up and you were pity and we take your wine and you were quiz, you gave me rugby tickets, I'll take your wine. It's very well monitored. And I think, so it's one thing making for a producer to make 40,000 bottles of wine and get all the covets and the glory and make up a big name for him or herself. But you try making 9 to 10 million bottles of wine of quality, not necessarily high priced, not necessarily 5 star platter quality, but good quality wine at 10 to 15 million bottles. You need a hell of a good winemaking team to do that. You need farmers planting the vineyards correctly, growing the right grapes. So I think they have an enormous role to play, because without the co-ops, this industry would be dead. Now, we wouldn't have a presence. A category like wine needs a presence. And that's why I have a big issue with judges coming over like Tim Atkin, because they never look at big producers. They only regard the small producers as the 95-point pluses. As soon as you start producing more than 800,000 bottles of wine, you just shove to the side. You're in the gray zone. Whereas in New Zealand, for example, Cloudy Bay, you know Cloudy Bay, it's one of the preeminent Sauvignon Blancs in the world, found in all the world's restaurants, it's got great status. Yeah. They make 12 million bottles a year. So we must get away from this thing in South Africa. We in the media and other wine commentators get away from this thing that if you make a lot of wine, you can't make good wine. I think that's nonsense. You can make big brands and good quality as well.
I think that a lot of people from our generation are a whole lot more tolerant of, in fact, not tolerant, but hugely supportive of cooperatives. The co-ops were very, very supported when I was sort of growing up, when I first started drinking wine. And if I remember that you could buy Swartland's a co-op, Shiraz and Chenin Blanc for next to nothing. It was completely and utterly delicious. And then when I got into the wine industry and I started doing quite a bit of judging, I was always terrified, because people used to make a joke and say, oh my God, you know, go and judge Old Mutual Trophy or something, and what if the Swartland Chenin comes up? Well, you know what? It would be a feather in anybody's cap if the Swartland Chenin won the Old Mutual White Wine Trophy. It's really cracking good wine. It really is. And I think that there's too much emphasis now on all these tiny little producers. It's nice, and it's quite sort of twee,
it's
and
fantastic.
It's garage yeasty, and it's good, but it's not brilliant for the industry. It's not making a lot of money for the industry. It's also very frustrating for the wine enthusiast who wants to taste those wines, but because it's so little, that private producer has to charge 750 rand for a bottle of Chenin Blanc that the likes of Joe Bloggs is never going to taste. So, Tim Atkin and myself had this discussion in this very studio, where I said to him, we need to start awarding cooperatives We do. People need to start knowing that they can be drinking award-winning wines from a co-op. Mm-hmm. It's not only those tiny little, millions of tiny little producers who are producing 40 and 50 cases of wine. Yeah. Do you agree?
And it's so important to emphasize that.
Mm.
Because it's a problem to find bad wine in South Africa these days. Really bad wine.
I must say, our quality is really, really good. Listen, we've also got, like every wine producing country, we've got some completely ghastly wine. You have to know that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you not hear me again, Emil? It's the dog next door. That's why you can't hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You're looking at me as if there's someone in there, but the lights...
Well, you're... No, I can hear you, but you're freezing up. I can't see you.
Oh,
you're not
am
moving
I?
Unless it's an act. Unless you're acting like Emma Stone and not moving, but otherwise it's just all. No, but there is a lot of obviously, but I think it's an important point that we have great. I mean, I take a wine like Alto, for example. You know, Alto makes 600,000-700,000 bottles of wine, and I really think that they are of the best producers in Helderberg. But for some of the reason, the perception is that's because they used to be part of Distell, and perhaps the perception is they've always been around, and they're not as expensive as the other wines are. But I mean, Alto Rouge, to me, is one of the great wines from the Helderberg. You know what fabulous addresses they are. So it's a perception thing, and I think people in the media and commentators should be more open-minded and realize that, because it'll benefit a large part of the wine-drinking public.
I agree with you, but in deference to my friend Tim Atkin, he actually cited Alto Rouge as his best value red wine in his report last year. Do you know that?
Best value, value.
You know, best value red. He said it was for the money you pay bank.
Whenever you see best value, it's like an almost comer.
You're being one of those sensitive Cape Townians now.
Yeah. It's our industry. I'm right here. I have a right to be sensitive. No, just say, because people get an impression. They think they must spend 300 rand to get a good wine. If you're only reading the wine, the public reckon, because they see
maybe
people writing about...
Maybe the public, the people in Durban.
But perhaps it is so. But the people write about wines... Pay attention to wines, 300, 400, 500 rand. If we had more of an effort,
the wine journalists,
if they put
a big
had more up. Of an effort of highlighting with excellent wines you get between 80 rand and 140 rand, it would tell the normal wine drinker, you know, I can also drink a good wine at an affordable price. You know, you mentioned the name Canonical, everybody runs a mile because it's expensive. Unless you tell them it's a cadet at 110, 120 rand. And I think that's a success of something like Canoncorp, who's taken a premium wine, an image, into a place.
And you tell them that Canoncorp, to be fair to them, kept their prices reasonable for the top, I believe the top first growth in the country remains Canoncorp.
Yeah.
And for many, many, many years, that wine was... 300, 400, 500 rand cheaper than some of the newer blends that had been put on the market that had none of the track record that Canoncorp had.
No, for sure.
So
exactly.
You know, I think
that's where it happens.
And I think that.
But when are we seeing you down here again? Because our connection seems to be dying here, Carrie. I don't know what it is.
What should we do, Cal? Callum is immediately saying it's not my fault.
Because mine says fine from my side.
Yeah, ours does too.
Either way, it uploads to Riverside, so the stuttering audio and stuff.
Oh, he's saying either way it uploads to Riverside, so the stuttering doesn't come through on the final edit. But it's difficult to get the energy and the what have you that we need when you're talking like this. So should we do a wrap-up? We'll cut this piece out and let's do a little wrap up, because it's now 25 or 30 minutes that we've been chatting. And let's talk about how you think one journalism can polish its marble a bit to how one journalism could possibly polish its marble a bit, how we all have a responsibility to get those cheaper wines out onto the marketplace.
Look, it's a difficult thing, Carrie. I think journalism itself, wine journalism itself is on its last legs. Serious wine writing. If you remember 30, 40 years ago, every newspaper had a wine column. All of them.
Yes, yes.
Even the ones in Joburg. Especially... Especially, no, but every news, Rand Daily, Mail, Citizen, Bild, Volks Blad, Mercury, Herald, God, everybody, Bronkhorstspruit Times. and we know what was happening with media. I mean, when I worked at the newspaper, we had an editorial staff of 26 at Die Burger. They now have three. So wine is not a priority.
Really?
It's receiving less print space. And what the media is doing is extorting advertisements from you. Not all media, but a lot of media. They say, right, if you want your wine in the magazine with the Coq en Vin or Susie and Sandra's Briani, you have to pay for it. It's not like the old days where Susie and Sandra would personally select the wines. They will now just take any wine and shove it there as long as the producer pays for it. So it's become a very grey line as far as that's concerned. So the opinion formers have become the digital influencers who've played a major role, a positive role, in actually getting wine out there as uncomplicated and part of a lifestyle. Instead of part of
paid,
a boardroom wine club set. So what we've lost on the swings, we've won on the roundabouts.
Emil, they also get paid, don't they?
Huh?
The digital influencers don't do it free of charge.
My friends do it for me because I'm such a nice guy.
You see... You probably
some try and extort some money from you, but I don't pay.
No.
But some of them do really do it for the love of they all got full-time jobs, and they do their wine communications and Instagramming and TikToking just for the love of it. And I think they deserve more honor than they're getting. I think the industry should point out a couple of influencers and honor them because they do a lot to keep the wine momentum going.
I think they should point out the...
Especially among a younger audience. And we've read all these reports that wine consumption and alcohol consumption amongst younger groups is actually declining globally. So the influencers really do something that's part of them that they want to share with others. And if it's wine... All credit to them, and I love them to death, and I kindly invite them to enjoy my experiences and to communicate that. But then the traditional wine media is obviously very important for producers. I mean, Tim Atkins, very important for producers. Plateau is important. But I think I would like to see, just from my side, as you said, that we don't... And as a journalist, it's always... sexy to find the story in a vegan winemaker who does boogie boarding and makes five barrels of wine with three dogs and has got a wife who's a Mormon and they used to live in a camper van. You know, that's a lekker story. But a Moose Big Co-op in the middle of nowhere harvesting 40,000 tons.
That's so exciting.
We're seven winemakers are basically running a wine factory. It's not a lack of story, but the ability of them to turn out good wine, to me, is just as an interesting story. So I think we should be a bit more open to that.
I think that people like you and me need to go on a road trip and find those cooperative people. He's swearing again, Callum. I don't think he can see me.
I can see you.
I think we need to go on a road trip, and we need to find those cooperative people, and we need to get them a bit tipsy around a fire one night and hear their stories and make their stories a bit sexier, because I'm sure they must have sexy stories, don't you think?
Yeah.
The Capetonian child is becoming very ADD. I think somebody sent you a message on your email.
Yeah. Now, I've just got a... I've got 100 things coming through at the moment. Sorry. So working hours down here in Cape Town, you know?
Okay. Are you paying attention to me now? Or are you reading
your emails? Yes, of course. I heard you.
I can see you reading your emails.
No, I'm not,
say,
I promise.
What
hand
did
on
I
my
say?
Heart. Something about coming down to Cape Town and sitting at a fire.
With whom?
That's what you said. And I did
who
think it's I did think it's time for that.
I think I'm gonna leave you to do your emails. Because I can I've lost your attention.
You haven't. It's just a WhatsApp call that keeps coming up on my screen. So I'm just dotting it down.
Tell her she can wait.
I've tried to do that. My French isn't that good. It's from France.
Well, you see, I have no chance against a little French kitty, do I?
So when are you coming down?
When you pay more attention to me, I'll come down.
Now, what I think you should do is you should come down and do a broadcast from here.
Well, maybe the signal will be a bit better.
That's what I think you should do.
And I can capture your attention a little bit more than I've managed to do today.
You've got my attention. But I said the screen was freezing up. Okay. I felt like a winemaker with a stuck fermentation. You know, you don't know what to do this side or that side. Have a heart. You're so hard on me. That's a businesswoman coming through. That's that hardcore business thing coming through. All nice talk now. But I remember when you had Solly Kramer, the people say, Carrie's such a nice girl, unless you want to smoggle her with a deal. I remember that. But don't come with that berating me for my lack of attention now.
You better go away, think carefully about your behavior today, and know that there's some serious atonement that has to happen, and we need to come up with a plan where I come and we go visiting with Grandpa Joubert, and we'll go to all the cooperatives, and we'll eke stories out of those young farmers who are making...
I'd love to cheer you around. I'd love to take you around.
I'm sure I could show
my invitation
to you as well.
I'll drive you and your whole production team, and we have a good one. We go to Elgin, De Wetsof, Dimmersdal, in the cellar, and we put you on the spot in the cellar. We taste through the barrels and everything.
That's a good idea. Maybe we'll work
on
a date to do that. I've got a bit of a busy year. I'm going to Mexico and I'm going to England I'm going all over.
Are you
going to
taste on there? You're tasting on some competition there.
I'm tasting in Mexico. I'm tasting in England. Tasting all over the place. Are you?
Oh, liquor.
Are you going anywhere? No.
Yeah, I'm probably going to Europe in June, like Portugal, France, Holland, do a bit of sales visits and so forth. Check up on the foreign markets.
I went to an aromatics tasting for Great Domains last night, and they were showing off some of their German and Alsatian Rieslings and Pinot Noirs. Emil, I wish you'd been with me.
No,
it
Alsace.
Was so gorgeous. It was so gorgeous. You can't even start to imagine. It really is.
No, Alsace is incredible, really.
One day, Pinocchio, when we grow up and we are a real man, we might be making Riesling like that, but it was an extraordinary privilege.
Yeah, no, those wines are so absolutely superb. And Pinot Grigio as well. And that area, Alsace, one of my favorite regions. And last time we spoke about Burgundy, I'll put Alsace close to Burgundy. But you in Joburg, you all have all those chances, those opportunities. We don't have that many down here.
Well, you treat me to things in Cape Town, I'll treat you to those kind of things in Johannesburg. We've got lots to do. I'm going to go because our connection's been quite bad. I'm going to say thank you so, so much for wrapping up the harvest for us. So we can expect some really, really nice things.
Buy the wines. Put them, if you're ordering into some of these big wineries, the Bosch Kloofs or the Jordans or the Tybos, so get those order. I think the red wines are going to be amazing. And the little Chardonnay there is as
well. And the whites?
Mark my words.
Done. We're taking your word for it, and we'll get everybody buying. I'll tell you when this is up. We'll get everybody to comment on a rather irreverent wrap-up of the 2024 vintage in Cape Town from Emile Joubert. Emile,
that's
thank you
the way
so
it goes.
Much once again. Always. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Carrie. Lekker soos 'n cracker.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.